I am exhausted.
About
I'm exhausted.
What are you exhausted about? Yeah, long because day, I've been up early with the kid. What?
Because I've been fighting battles all day, sir. I've been
fighting
the good fight.
Don't. Why?
The fighting the good fight about why? Fighting.
Why? What's the point? Why do you do that to yourself?
That's, I don't know, man.
You are, listen, you arguing on Twitter about fighting is the same as hitting your head on the wall three times. Hey, Wish, why are you doing that? Oh, because it feels good when I stop. Why would you do that?
Here's the problem with it, man. Like, when we start doing this dance and engaging the anti-fighting crowd about this sort of thing and trying to discuss the nuances and the tangible effects and all that stuff, it boils down to something that I know sticks in your craw, which is observable evidence versus quantitative evidence. Mm-hmm. And the stats crowd, for some reason, has a huge hard-on about getting fighting out of hockey. So then it becomes a situation where if you can't prove that a fight led to a goal and you can't prove that a fight led to a win, well, then fighting is worthless and therefore should be taken out of the game.
Yet they never apply the same philosophy to power plays. If a power play doesn't lead to a goal or doesn't lead to a win, no one talks about getting power plays out of the game.
But I'm glad you brought that up, because a power play or a penalty kill can do what?
Change momentum.
Yes. Change the emotion, change the momentum, see it shift. Now, there are some people, and this hasn't been brought up today, but I've had this debate with other people before, that believe the ebb and flow of a hockey game is a natural course and that there is no such thing as momentum. Momentum will happen regardless of events, which, of course, is probably news to the Boston Bruins when Nathan Horton got knocked out. Hmm. But I do believe that fighting can change the emotional dynamic in a game depending on the fight, the combatants, the context. I defer to coaches like Dan Bylsma that have identified fights in the past and say, yes, this actually did have an impact on the momentum in the game.
Oh, by the way, my favorite part is when those same people on Twitter say, well, you can't listen to what coaches and players say. They're lying. Okay. All right. Let's not actually listen to the primaries and how they feel about it.
What do you think, though? Because I was just on with Connor McKenna, our buddy on the radio, mm-hmm. And he brought up the idea that the fighting ban or a fighting rollback or restrictions need to happen independent of how the players feel about it, because they often don't know what's good for them.
Here, hang on a second.
And he brought up player safety, brought up the helmets, the face shields, yeah, the icing, the whole thing, and said, well, maybe the 98% of NHLPA members that in February 2012 said there should not be a ban on fighting – maybe the good majority of them don't know what's good for them, and therefore a fighting ban should be applied despite their feelings.
Why isolate players? I'll tell you something. Here, you want to break it all down. You want to break down, what the fighting vibe is right now, or where we're at with fighting in the league. The players overwhelmingly, I mean, was it 97% was the vote? When the NHL tried to dip their toe in the water of getting rid of fighting, 97% overwhelmingly said, no, we'd like to leave it in. And that includes stage fights. The players want it. You know who else wants it as part of the game? The owners of all 30 NHL franchises want it as part of their product, part of the game that they sell. And you know who else wants it in the game? The overwhelming, and I mean overwhelming, majority of fans who have the nerve to buy tickets. Whenever I hear Wish, a media type who gets on his or her high horse about fighting in the game and how it's hindering hockey and it's allowing, it's a speed bump to the way of greater riches and greater promise for this great sport of hockey. I always say one thing. If we took fighting out of the game, would you buy a ticket? And if the answer is yes, then I think we take that person a little more seriously than if they say no. Because a lot of people that are asked about this, and I can only speak, because I haven't seen statistics in the United States, but statistics in Canada, it's always, 40% of Canadians say it's time to get rid of fighting.
Right.
That's key. That is key in all this. And I know this is a Canadian media-driven thing, and I'm very well aware of it. But how many of those people identify themselves as people who buy tickets, who consume the National Hockey League, other than casually observing one game on a Saturday night because that's what they've been grown up to do. It's not a matter of passion. It's a matter of habits.
And I'll take the American view on this, the flip side of that coin. The thing that you often hear from anti-fighting advocates is, well, if you take fighting out of the game, you're going to reach new audiences. As if there's a World War Z swarm of zombie sports fans trying to crest over a dam that's keeping them in place because fighting is in hockey. As if hockey does not have other obstacles to reaching that audience, like, oh, I don't know, racial demographics, the fact the game is alien and nobody plays it, the fact the rules are complicated, the fact there's a team in Ottawa that comes to your town and most Americans don't know where it is. Like, there are so many other obstacles to hockey reaching that audience that fighting is, wait for it, actually one of the things that you can reach out to that audience and say, here's something you know about, because a lot of people have been in fights. A lot of people watch UFC. They watch boxing. They understand a fight. Hmm. You know what happens in non-traditional markets, Merrick? You know what they do? They market fighting in the ECHL. They market fighting back in the CHL days. They market fighting to these audiences because that's what they understand more than icing, more than offsides, more than a red line, more than anything that's about the game. They understand a fight, and that's why it becomes an entry point to the game for those communities. I always say this, I'll do it again. When the Nashville Predators began playing in Nashville, do you know who the first marketable player on that roster was? The guy they hyped. Mm. It wasn't David Legwan.
Was it Cote? It was
Stu Grimson.
Stu Grimson, okay, yeah. I knew he was a tough guy. Okay.
And there's a reason for that. It's because the audience they were trying to reach, trying to get in the building, because it's all about getting you in the building. You get them in the building, and then you learn the game after that. The audience they were trying to reach would understand a giant mountain of a man named the Grim Reaper more than they would what a power play looks like. Okay, now, that's the bottom line.
Yeah, and there is a feeling out there. I mean, let me phrase this in way of a question here for you. There is a sentiment out there that the NHL is doing a disservice to future hockey fans by allowing fighting because, in some people's imaginations, the presence of fighting in the NHL prevents parents from putting their kids into hockey. Ignoring things like, I don't know, the game is so wildly overpriced
that
economically it's keeping kids out. No, it's a presence of fighting.
Your boy Damian Cox put that out there this morning,
did he?
By the way. Oh, yeah, he did. He did. And I was, again, as I've mentioned on this podcast before, I had to hold it back. He almost got me again. And you're right. And here in the States, it's a different story even in Canada. It's not only the price of the game that holds kids back from playing it. It's the ready availability of ice. It's the fact that all of their friends aren't playing hockey. I mean, there's a number
of
obstacles to the game that I'm worried my kid's going to take a punch.
When you look at the idea of growing the game, and to your point about it, there's not a zombie army waiting for the NHL to remove fighting to, you know, start buying tickets and buying jerseys and go to Winter Classics and the such. The best way to make hockey fans is not to remove fighting. The best way to make hockey fans is put hockey sticks in people's hands. Right. Want to make hockey fans? Make them hockey players. That's the way that you do it. And I don't know any parents, actually, that say, you know what, I was going to put my kid in hockey, but they fight in the NHL, so no, I'm not going to do it. Now, as far as fighting bans goes, I'm fine with fighting bans all the way up until professional hockey. You want to take fighting out of junior tomorrow? Dave Branch, I'm cool with it. I'm fine. I understand that. You know, I don't like the thought of, you know, 16-year-olds getting beaten up by 20-year-olds, that considering the way the kids develop from the ages of 16 to 20. I get that, and I would support that. And it's amateur, and they're not professional athletes. They get a $60 stipend every week, and that's it. I would be fine with that. I would understand that. But I'm sorry, it's different. It's different at the pro level. It is completely different at the pro level, and everybody knows what the score is. And to the point about, you know, you talked about fighting, producing, and shutting down momentum, both pro and con, yin yang, all of it. A lot is always made about, oh, the stage fight. Here comes the dancing bears. It doesn't mean anything for the game. What staged fight.
John Scott is a bit of a dancing bear, and you have to admit.
He's kind of a, yeah,
him,
I know.
You could see him with one of those multicolored balls with a star on it on his nose.
Oh, it's a duck-footed skater. Oh, it's John Scott. He's going to come beat up an $8 million Phil Kessel. The other thing that it does, other than shift momentum, is it also diffuses certain things. Like, there are some games you go to, there are some games you watch, and by way of the rivalry, and I do want to get to rivalry tonight, by the way, on NBC. But in some rivalries and in some games, there is a violent tension that exists. It is palpable. You can feel it. You can't quantify it with fancy stats, right? No one's come up with that one yet, but you can feel it. You know when there is an air of violent and the potential for a really violent and dangerous act to happen. There is that type of tension in the air for that game. What happens when the quote-unquote, as the smug self-righteous crowd calls them, the dancing bears come out? What does that do? It diffuses the tension. The fight is over and the game settles in and the game becomes the game. The fight. Now, it doesn't always happen that way. And then, trust me, there are some stage fights that are pretty dumb. And I understand. And there are some stage fights where guys just sort of justify their existence and justify their paychecks. I've heard plenty of stories of, hey, bud, I got to get a couple more on my dance card so I get a job next year. I can't only have, 10 on my dance card this year. They're going to say, oh, he's scared. He's not fighting as much as he used to. And I understand that. I get that. That is purely selfish, nothing to do with the game. But there are plenty of times, too, where the two heavyweights go out there, the guys that play 5 minutes a game, and they diffuse the tension in a game. Boom, the air comes out of the bubble, and the players can play the game. That's what happens.
And listen, I don't like getting in fights with guys like Dello because I don't want to take a run at the advanced stats community. I follow advanced stats. I think they're important. But I just find that the addiction to quantifying things as a hockey fan is really annoying because there's some things that merely are observable. When you're at a game and you see your team sleepwalking through a period against the Florida Panthers on a Tuesday night in front of 14,000 fans, and then a fight happens and the next three or four shifts have energy, it may not result in a goal. It may not result in a win. But you can't deny that it changes the dynamic of a game sometimes. The biggest head-pounding thing about this argument is the fact that when you argue with an anti-fighting guy, it's the broadest, largest brush you can possibly find that they're painting with. They put the staged fights under the same umbrella as the revenge fights, as under the same umbrella as the precautionary fights, as the passion fights. There's so much nuance to this thing that goes beyond had fight, didn't score a goal, Neanderthal, concussion time, that I want to have that argument, but no one else seems to want to because the anti-fighting people are just so staunch in their belief that it's a worthless venture, ignorant of what the players say, ignorant of what the GMs and the coaches say, that they decide to group everything under the same umbrella, and it makes the argument so – I had someone argue today that a fight – leading to a positive benefit for a team is so coincidental. It's like saying hockey players can cure sick kids just by being hockey players. Like, that's the level of discourse that we have on this issue.
I understand where the anti-fighting crowd is coming from. And you know what? I really believe that their heart is in the right place, right? I believe in taking care of people. I believe in looking after people. I believe in trying to make, the world as safe a place as possible. I understand that. I'm your hippie buddy here. This is Jeff here, right? I understand all that. I get all that. But these are grown professional men who know exactly what the score is. And the thing that infuriates me about the fighting debate that we're having today is it comes after George Parros and Colton Orr last night. And it didn't come from, a dirty moment in the fight. It didn't come from an eye gouge in the fight. It didn't come from, one fighter's going down and another fighter punches him while he's on the ice and knocks him out. It came from an accident in a fight.
Yeah.
Where George Parros hit his jaw on the ice. And right away on Twitter, and I hate this and I feel bad for this person's family, this deceased person's family. Right away, everyone goes to Don Sanderson.
Everyone goes
to Don Sanderson.
Let me just dial it back here for a second because I'm going to hop off this train for a second and say to you that injury occurred because of the fight. I mean, the injury occurred because Colton Orr had a hold of his jersey. He fell to the ice holding that jersey. Perros face planted. Were it not for the fight, that scenario doesn't exist anywhere else outside of, I mean, even if it's a holding penalty, he's not going to be holding him by the collar.
No, so but the point is, it is an accident that happened during a fight.
Right, but the fight led to an injury, though. Like, but the injury doesn't occur if it's not for the fight.
A couple of things happened last night. Okay, so that was the early CBC game, late CBC game last night, Winnipeg against Edmonton. What's worse, what happened with Colton Orr and George Perros, or what happened with Ladislav Smead and Mark Scheifele, where Smead hits him from behind, cross-check to the back of the net, face into the boards, into the glass? What's worse? What should we be talking about today? And what is the real scourge in the NHL?
And that's the thing, right? Like, the people always seem to blur those lines. Blurred lines between fighting and everything else. And the thing that we'll always come back to is fighting is essentially voluntary. Outside of guys getting, I mean, it wasn't voluntary for Kessel.
It wasn't a fight.
Yeah, but you're right. It wasn't a fight either. But getting hit in the head, getting a stick to your face, getting hit from behind, these are not voluntary things. It's apples and oranges. It really is. Couple of things on the fighting thing before we start the show proper. First off, Stephan Jones, which I believe is Stephan Jones, Stephan Jones. Has been bringing the smarts on
really
fighting.
Good, I mean, stuff. Yeah,
can't quantify it, but that doesn't mean that it has value or doesn't have value. And again, saying the thing that I've said since the 1990s, which is that for all of this, Tom was just talking about this before. For all this talk about fighting being a detriment to the NHL reaching new fan bases or whatever, I mean, UFC crashes in NASCAR. The violence in the NFL before the concussion lawsuit. I mean, all of these things, these sports make money hand over fist because of violence.
But again, I will bring up the example of my favorite topic, me. If fighting went away tomorrow, I wouldn't. And there are some in the NHL believe that there are enough me's in the world that there's a risk reward. You can risk losing a lot of fans if you get rid of hockey fights. But the risk is, or that the gamble is, are there enough Jeff Merricks out there who will stay with the game even if fighting's gone, and will bring in new audience that'll be greater than the audience that we have now that adores hockey fights? But again, to what the gentleman who just emailed, Stephan Jones, just said, I have yet to see actual evidence that fighting inhibits non-fans from watching, or I'd even go one further, as I mentioned earlier on, from buying tickets.
Two things real quick before we start the show. First is that the biggest single straw man argument in any fighting debate is, well, you don't see it in the playoffs and you don't see it in the Olympics.
Yes, you do, but you do see it in the playoffs. You don't see it in the Olympics.
You don't see it in world championships. Yes. In fact, you're right.
You see it in the playoffs.
But you see it in the playoffs, but not as much as you see it in the regular season. But, my point is that there is, shockingly, a different dynamic in an elimination tournament that can be roughly 28 games, or in international play fewer than that, and an international play single elimination, and an international play oftentimes all-star teams, than there is in an 82-game regular season in which you need to get your boys fired up when you play the Florida Panthers on a Tuesday night.
Thank you.
It's exactly true. There is a different dynamic. That's amazing. You were able to notice that. The other thing is, I wrote about Gary Bettman this morning. I'm not going to rehash the entire article, but His main point on fighting has been my main point on fighting forever, which is that if you flip a switch and try to ban it, the consequences are terrible. The consequences mean that there's going to be other outlets for that kind of stuff. The policing goes out the window. We're going to see more stick work. I truly believe the game becomes more cheap, more violent, more deplorable without fighting there. You take the cork out and the evil comes out of the bowels of the earth. That's how I feel about it.
That said,
I agree inherently with what Bettman says, which is that when fighting goes, and I believe it will diminish to the point where it is the exception rather than the rule, when fighting goes, it will happen organically. There are so many levels of hockey right now in which there are fighting bans. Yeah. Guys are coming up into this league no longer having to fight their way there. It's already changing based on the levels that we saw 20 years ago versus the levels now, based on the lack of designated fighters today versus even 10 years ago. The dynamic's changing. There's no reason to flip the switch, unless, of course, the reason the NHL would do it is if there was a death. And all of a sudden, the advertisers are like, we can't be on board with this unless you ban it because someone died. That's when it would stop.
Mm-hmm. Here's the way I'll phrase it here. You know, as I said earlier, the owners want it. The players want it. The vast majority of fans want it. People have the nerve to buy tickets, all want it. It is going exactly nowhere. It will not leave hockey. You can argue about it all you want on Twitter. You can do blogs and newspaper columns full of how fighting is destroying the game. You know, I was reorganizing my office in the Summer Wish, and I've got this stack of hockey news magazines that goes back to like 1961 or 1959 or whatever. And it's funny, I was thumbing through some of the early ones, and you know what a recurring theme is? How the violence in hockey will destroy the game. It's this wish. It's the same conversation over and over again. Okay, at least we're getting it out of the way on day one of the season this year. Like, let's just have the conversation and get it out of the way. But arguing about getting rid of fighting is like arguing about getting rid of the shootout. It's useless. Right, Wish?
I completely disagree with that. With that, let's start the show proper, shall we?
He's Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet.
Don't you give the guy a little bit of rope this year?
No.
What's give him point? No rope. No rope. I want to see the guy that flops. He's, you know, the Faith No More video. That's the guy you want to see.
Are you kidding? Babcock's going to Bilesma this sucker.
Oh, yes. My Dick Tracy like good looks. Yes. The gentleman's parlor.
And Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
I don't know if you know, but the Atlantic Division has been renamed as the Metropolitan Division. You have any thoughts about that?
Is it really?
Yeah.
He's a top-line player for the Carolina Hurricanes, and I still think of his Schwantz when I hear that name. I don't want to take a shit on the Devils. Rangers fans do that every day for me.
Debate hockey.
Can someone please break it to Phil? He's very sensitive. They always boo him in Boston.
This high-sticking review brought to you by...
Well, listen, we're having
Cialis.
A debate.
Cialis, there it is.
We're having a
brought
debate.
Brought to you by Hard-On Pills.
We're
just high-sticking.
We're having a debate, and this dissension is sponsored by Doritos.
Pop culture.
He's wound so tight, all right? Like Cameron Fry, the Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Lump of Coal, the Diamond. If he's wound that tight on the day of an exhibition game, probably not a good time to be playing.
Not a good time to be
not a good time.
No.
Merrick versus Wyshynski.
Indeed. Coming up on the show, because we like to offer all different angles and aspects of a debate, Matthew Barnaby.
Who is standing by? By the way, former NHLer, hockey analyst Matthew Barnaby joins us now. How are you today, Matt?
I'm great, guys. How are you?
Well, it wasn't much of a disagreement because Greg and I are on the exact same page about the any type of, you know, fighting ban in the NHL. And as much as this is positioned as a MVSW, it in this case, it really isn't. But where are you at on the tiresome, boring, worn out discussion? I was just saying, I went through some hockey news magazines in the summer from 1961. The same conversations then are the same conversations that get hashed out now when George Perros sits his head on the ice. Where are you at on the fighting debate, Matt?
Yeah, you can use the analogies all over and they'll still be redundant, but it's worth pointing out. So I'm a guy that loves it. I did a job, I did it for years, and to me it's part of the game. It's never going to change my mind. I understand there is risk. I understand guys do get hurt. I retired with 14 concussions, and I'm still adamant that we keep it in the game. I just think I know we say it's part of our sport, but I do think there's entertainment. And I think for all the fights that do happen, you know, the amount of time someone actually does get hurt, yes, we risk concussions. We risk getting punched in the face. I get it all. But this was a freak accident. Again, he fell, he slipped, and he couldn't protect himself. But I think for all the fights that we do have, there aren't that many guys that get hurt on a serious base. So I'm totally on the side that we keep it in the game.
I think the NHL has muddied the waters on this, Matt, because like when you spend the last decade talking about player safety and doing all of these things to take out headshots and protect players along the boards, and now we've got hybrid icing and equipment getting better and all this stuff, and at the out of the other side of your mouth, you're talking about fighting. I think it's become really hard for a lot of fans to square that, where the NHL can be all about player safety in one aspect and then kind of winkingly allow something where two guys are hitting each other in the face.
Yeah, I think they are scared to crap of the NFL lawsuit and what could come of that. And I'm sure at some point we'll see one with the NHL. So I think, you know, don't get me wrong. Do I think fighting will be out of the game at some point? Yes, I do. I think evolution will take it out of the game. It doesn't mean that I'm not a proponent for keeping it in there, but I think at some point it will be taken out just because of, well, first of all, media pressure. I think we hear about it every time someone gets hurt. There's that pressure, and it's brought back up, like you said, since 1961. We keep hearing the debate whether it should be in the game. I think we will lose it, but I think it's more of a media pressure. I think it's a financial pressure, one that from the courts, and we talk about the kind of money that the NFL got. This one could reach the same amount of dollars. So I think there's just that fear that if they don't take it out, that they're just creating another can of worms to be opened further down that could cost them a lot of money.
What did you think yesterday, Matthew, when you saw George Parros, his face hit the ice yesterday in the Colton Orr fight? What went through your mind right away? Like, what was your initial thought?
You know what? First, I was up there. I was doing an event for Scotiabank up in Toronto, watching the game with fans and with sponsors, and it was great because it was an open game. There was a lot of mistakes. Defensively, it was just a terrible game from that aspect, but it was exciting. It was fun, a 4-3 game. And then you see something like that, and it just goes deafening quiet. To see a good guy, a guy that knows his role, and just to be laying there defenseless, to see Colton Orr waving on trainers and doctors to come on, to see a guy that, like I said, is a great guy laying on the ice, not knowing where he is, very tough to take, worrisome. And again, today, when you know he's out and it is a concussion and hopefully nothing more than that, I think that we're all happy, glad. But it's just it takes your heart right away. You just feel sick to your stomach, like anytime anyone gets hurt, but especially when it is a face injury.
Indeed, indeed. Anyways, moving to the stuff that's happening in this league right now. What are your thoughts first, sir, about realignment? Who do you think benefits the most from dropping to two divisions in each conference and some teams moving from conference to conference?
Well, I think when I look at the whole thing, it's Detroit. I think like a lot of people, they've wanted it for a long time, and to play in your own time zone, to get to play, to me, in the Eastern Conference, I think Detroit is going to benefit the most because of it. I think they're going to a division that is tough. It's not a walkover, but the bottom end of that division is pretty easy, and I think they're going to have an easier time, even though they've been very, very successful. The way that they play hockey, I think, is going to be great for them to be in a division with Boston and Buffalo and Toronto. I think they're going to have a great time, and I think they benefit mostly because of it. So a little bit more difficult for some teams now to make the playoffs. Obviously, you want to have it perfect where there's the amount of right amount of teams in each division. Unfortunately, that didn't happen, but hey, we know expansion is coming right around the corner. We're going to have a few more teams, and it'll line perfectly, and we'll have have not only probably $300 million in expansion money coming each for the owners, but also perfect realignment.
I have news for you, Matthew Barnaby. I distinctly heard Gary Bettman in the last Tuesday say, We've never had a discussion about expansion. Why do people think we're going to expand? Are you saying he's wrong, sir?
I'm not saying he's wrong. I'm saying he's lying. He's going the opposite end. I think he's playing the fifth there. No, it's we all know it's coming. We all know that the teams in the cities. I'm going to be very excited. I can't wait for Quebec to get another team, having played junior there, and they're not building an arena for nothing out there. So there'll be expansion. We know that. He can say whatever he wants. He's growing the game. He's going to grow it even more, and the best game on earth will get two more teams in the near future.
The very excellent Matthew Barnaby with us. Tonight we will have, Matthew, our first look at Patrick Waugh, the NHL coach. He's also, you know, director of player personnel. He'll make the trades. He'll call the general managers. But from a coaching point of view, plenty of coaches have made the transition before from coaching in junior to the NHL, but we've never seen one with quite the high profile as Patrick Waugh. How do you think he makes out in his first year as a head coach?
You know, I don't know about in the first year how he's going to do, and I don't think he's going to do well at all because of the team he has. This is a young team that still has a lot of growth growth ahead of them. But, you know, the addition of McKinnon certainly will help this young core, but they still have a lot of growing. The difference between Patrick Waugh and I think some of the well-renowned coaches and star players that try to become coaches, and I've been coached by one that was a terrible coach, great guy, but terrible coach, that will be named at a later date, but great guy. And I think when you look at the transition from star player to coach, it came so easy most of the time for star players, and the game came easy. Coaching is tough. Coaching is breaking down film and watching how not only the star players play, because they think the game a different way, is seeing how fourth liners play, how third liners play, and how to break things up when things just came naturally. So I think when I look at Patrick Waugh, I think he has the mentality. He's a winner. But more importantly than being a winner and a star player, he's got a determination and a fire that is second to none. And I think that hard work that he was willing to put in junior, riding the buses and doing it the right way, it wasn't just given to him. It wasn't just say, hey, you're going to start your head coaching job with the Colorado Avalanche and the NHL, but you've already put your time in. We know what you can do. We know you're a fiery competitor, but you're willing to put the work in. And I think that's going to help him make him a successful coach. I think out of anyone that we've seen of the star players have a chance, I think he will be one to really surprise us, or at least demonstrate what we think should be as star players, as coaches.
Now, you can plead the fifth on this one, but I'm guessing the coach you're referring to is Brian Trotsche.
You went back. I'm guessing you're on a computer right now pulling up the teams I played for.
Well, I just think I'm trying to think of the coaches you had, because, I mean, you had Lindy Ruff, you had John Tortorella. I mean, these weren't exactly, you know, star coaches. Star player, so I'm guessing Trotsche with the Rangers.
It was a little earlier than I planned on revealing it, but yes, Brian Trotsche was the man, a great and kind gentleman, but absolutely horrific coach.
Got it out of him. All right, good.
There you go. Here you go. Indeed.
And I've had a few horrific coaches that weren't star players, so I guess that's fair.
Well, here's a question too, because you had him in Tampa. What was John Tortorella like as a coach for you?
You know, John Tortorella is a good guy, and one thing I appreciated from John was how honest he was. They had signed me to a 3-year contract, and within literally 4 months, he told me that I couldn't play, that I didn't skate well enough to play for him or even play in the National Hockey League. So where I didn't like some of his in-game tactics and the way he treated players, he's tough. I mean, he's tough on days you lose. It's not fun coming to the rink. I get that. But to make you uncomfortable, and the way that he goes about things is very wearing and very taxing on players. So he's a short-term coach. He's not a guy you want to play for 10 years, or if you look at like a Barry Trotz. The NHL has changed. Guys have changed. He's going to have to change his role. And he's admittedly said that, the way he treats people in the media and everything around it. He's going to have to change that if he wants to be a long-term coach. And he's had success. He's won a again, great guy. I didn't enjoy playing for him, but he has had success.
Who do you think has the tougher transition? A Tortorella coach team trying to play for Alain Vigneault, or an Alain Vigneault team trying to play for John Tortorella?
Well, without a doubt, a tougher transition is trying to play for Torts. I think the New York Rangers are going to say, wow, this is awesome. I got a guy that's a lot of times in a good mood. Alain Vigneault is no pushover. He's a tough guy, a tough coach. He loves a tough style of game, but I think he's going into a situation where they're going to love that change, and that change was needed. I don't know if that same feeling was in Vancouver, because they've had a lot of success out there over the years, never a Stanley Cup, but they've had a lot of success. And to ask the Sedins and some of those guys to be throwing your face in front of a 90-mile-an-hour slap shot, I don't know if it's going to be conducive to everyday loving John Tortorella, but hopefully for them, they find that happy medium, and hopefully he changes a little bit, and it's all roses there in Vancouver.
Hey, talk to us here as a player. Greg and I were talking about this on one of the podcasts last year. True or false, one of the things players can't stand, like maybe can't stand more than anything else, is getting chirped from the bench by a coach of the opposition team, someone who's not going to come on the ice and be accountable for it. On a scale of 1 to 10, how annoying is that for a player, Matthew?
You know, it's very annoying. And a couple of times I was coached by players, and some of those coaches now are GMs, and you just have to have a response. Always, at least in my role, I always knew I was going to be chirped and by players or whatever it may be, and I always had a response. You know, I grew up without a dad, so players would chirp me sometimes on that. You always have to have a response, and that's the same thing for a coach. Know your research. Be ready to chirp them back. And it's funny you bring that up, because I have a 15-year-old son that plays, and he actually got chirped by a coach the other day.
Oof.
And on the ice, after my son scored a goal, he got chirped, and it was not really nice. So I went to the coach after, and I said, if you're going to chirp a 15-year-old, you better have a really damn good one. And if you want to chirp a Burnaby, I guess I'm the guy you should be chirping, not a kid that's 104 pounds and hasn't hit puberty yet. So you're a very tough guy. But, yeah, it's annoying, very annoying, to say the least.
Was there one or two particular coaches you like to give it right back to more than anyone else?
You know what? When I look back, Ken Hitchcock and me had some pretty good ones going back and forth. I seen a torment his teams, and in the media a couple times he said I was an awful player, and I said he was a good coach, but a few other things that we'll leave off the air. But
so is that why? I mean, I'm assuming he sent him out there. Is that why Todd Harvey hit you with that elbow? Is that right from Hitch?
You know what? I don't know if he sent him out to do that. I hope not. I think Todd was just an idiot at the time, who I actually like a lot now. But yeah, he hit me with the elbow, knocked me out, and I think some of my friends went to confront him in the bar after the game. They found out where he was and confronted him. But I was in La La Land, so I really didn't know where I was. But yeah, Hitchcock was one. Craig McTavish was another that we had some pretty good one-liners going back and forth.
Awesome.
Awesome stuff. All right, Matt Barnaby, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah,
on the
great
today.
Stuff.
Anything you want to plug today, sir? Anything you want to promote today?
Hockey camps, maybe?
You know what? Honestly, just our wonderful game. We're very lucky to have a season upon us. No delays, no nothing. Great hockey. And it looks like there's going to be some more goals this year, which is nice. I love seeing the shortened pads. I would have got 5 or 6 goals a year if they would have shortened the pads 10 years ago. So I wish these rules would have happened then.
That's a great point. So I think it's lost on a lot of people today. When you look back, only 3 games yesterday, Matthew, 26 goals. And I know it's only a one-day audit, but, man, did the NHL get off to a bang last night.
It did. And I think you look at, in Canada, it's always going to be what it is. It's a culture. It's really a way of life for them. So in the States, they want to see goals scored. Kids want to see goals scored, and it sells the game. So anything we can do to create more goals, it was awesome. I was listening to the Edmonton game on the radio on the way home. And just listening to the goals go in and a lead not being secure by 2 goals, that makes it very interesting and intriguing for fans to come.
Certainly true. Matthew, all right. Thanks so much for joining us, bud. We'll keep in touch.
All right, guys. Have a great show, and keep up the great work.
We'll definitely put that man on speed dial. Holy smokes. How's it taking this long to get Matthew Barnaby on the podcast?
I don't know.
Holy smokes.
I don't know. Good. Has he not been on before?
I think that was the maiden voyage. I think that's the first time.
Maybe.
I'd like to look over and ask our producer, but he's only been with us for a couple of weeks because we don't do very well with producers. They last about a year and then they're gone. I was gonna say, Matt, if we had him on, I'm like, Matt's been here for 2 weeks.
You've done a good job, sir.
You know, I always wondered. I was kind of on a fishing trip with Ken Hitchcock, but I kind of had a suspicion he was gonna go with Hitch because that was one of the more. Because as I understand it, I mean, Barnaby, he was. I mean, you could hear, like, you know, you do your research, prepare for, you know, for to be able to chirp people back. You know, do your essentially what he's saying is do your show prep, Greg. You know, do your advanced scouting when you know you're going in somewhere to have chirps coming back, because apparently he would drive Hitch crazy. He would drive Hitchcock nuts, and that's why I don't want to say he sent out Todd Harvey with the elbow, but wouldn't surprise him if he said, hey, someone should really do something about this Matthew Barnaby guy. Yeah, Todd Harvey just kind of happened to be there.
Darren Drager in the Drager Report quotes Steve Yzerman as saying, I believe a player should get a game misconduct for fighting. We penalize and suspend players for making contact with the head while checking in an effort to reduce head injuries, yet we allow fighting. We're stuck in the middle and need to decide what kind of sport do we want to be. Either anything goes and we accept the consequences or take the next step and eliminate fighting, says the former assistant general manager of the team that never fought and had Nick Lidstrom.
And interestingly enough,
coming out of the lockout, Steve Yzerman's point was, we've replaced the fourth line goon with the fourth line pest, and I don't think we're a better game for it.
Honestly, like, I understand that Dreger says that Yzerman's comments carry weight, significant weight. I don't buy that. Given his Hall of Fame playing career and years of playing alongside legendary tough guys in Detroit, such as Darren McCarty, Joe Kosher, and Bob Probert. Now, why does that carry weight? He's no longer a player. Like, he's now a guy who sees players as investments. He's now a guy who clearly doesn't want to see his guys get ended by a fight. He's on the other side of the fence now. Like, of course, if you asked him back in his playing days what he thought about fighting, and he glanced over and saw Probert and Kosher on the other side of the locker room, what was he going to say?
Get
it has
guys,
no value?
Get these guys out of here? Oh, and who's this McCarty guy, too? Get rid of him, too. I don't know about that.
But Ray Shiro says he's a strong advocate for cracking down on the NHL has a responsibility to consider a ban on fighting, he says. And then finally, Jim Rutherford.
They have, though. They have, and overwhelmingly, the players reject it.
And Jim Rutherford tells Dreger that we've got to get rid of fighting. It has to go. Which, again, it makes sense when your team is the Carolina Hurricanes. And in the year the Carolina Hurricanes went to the conference final last in 2009, they were 30th in the league in fighting.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, this may not necessarily be the greatest sample. By the way, there's been a lot of talk about tangible benefits to fighting, and here's what you need to know. I don't know how you quantify this, but I'm just going to put this out there. 2012, the four finalists in the NHL playoffs in both conferences.
Okay.
Rangers were second in major penalties, Devils 9th, Kings 17th, Coyotes 26th. 2011, Bruins were third. And then the rest of the teams were not in the top 10, San Jose, Canucks, Lightning. 2010, Philly and San Jose in the top 10 in major penalties, Habs and Hawks in the bottom 10 in major penalties. Again, how do you quantify it? There are certain teams that clearly benefit by knuckling up and being tough,
yeah.
Like the Bruins.
Sometimes it works, I keep saying it's like a power play. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean that it's worthless. Look, the Anaheim Ducks win in 2007. Boston Bruins win in 2011. It's not exactly a secret how they won their Stanley Cups.
Everybody points to the Red Wings and their run, and then nobody points to the Bruins being third in the league in majors when they won the Cup and fourth in the league in majors last season.
And at the Stanley Cup final.
I mean, yeah.
It's selective. It's very selective. That's all. But you're right. Like, honestly, I keep going. There is so much just like luck. Right? So much has to go right for you to win the Stanley Cup. I don't know that fighting helped the Boston Bruins win the Stanley Cup. I don't know that not fighting helped the Chicago Blackhawks win the Stanley Cup. I don't know. All I know is one team didn't fight, they won the Cup, another team did, and they won the Cup as well. What does it mean? I don't know. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. Does everything have to have an ultimate answer?
I like Shiro a lot, but he's going to be the first guy to talk about bringing fighting back the day that Sid gets hit.
Oh, man. When guys start taking runs at Sid and he goes out and gets another Steve McIntyre. You remember when Sid.
LaRock.
I know. Well, listen. It was one of my favorite quotes. Oh, God. It was so great. So Sid's coming back from the Conky, right? And they go and get Steve McIntyre. And McIntyre's interviewed about it. And he says, what are you doing here? And McIntyre says, well, Sidney Crosby is coming back. I'm here to make sure the transition goes smoothly.
Right. Exactly.
I know.
Hey, this is not to devalue what Yzerman said or any of these guys.
No.
But, you know, yeah, sure, we should look into banning fighting because we've looked into every other aspect of player safety. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, you don't do it.
It's like the Buffalo Sabres didn't carry a slugger when Milan Lucic came to town. And the best response they had the following game was to serve up Paul Gostad as meat for Milan Lucic in that fight.
But again,
what did
like,
they do?
But here's the thing, right? Like, if Yzerman's solution to this is that fighting should be a game as conduct, so John Scott fights once during his 6 minutes of ice time and then doesn't play again. That's already happening. Like, why is that going to – how is that possibly – then you're just going to have guys that, once again, are just sucking up roster spots, and they're designated fighters that they can just throw in there, have their fight, and then never play again.
Let me turn the page here quickly. I want to read a tweet that's going to make you feel good because it makes me feel good. Our dear friend, Canucks fan in SF, San Francisco, first time – this is so awesome. And she – and a great tweet, and it's a beautiful picture as well. First time listening to MVSW in a long time because I've been busy caring for my lockout baby.
Oh.
Congratulations, Canucks fan and SF.
Oh.
Isn't that great?
Lockout
That's
baby.
Awesome. Oh, it's fantastic. Lockout from, baby, too.
From lockout great. Baby to bonus baby, because we didn't have a show yesterday, we couldn't really address this, but your
Callum,
thoughts, sir?
Callum Atticus is his name. What a great
Whoa,
name. Yeah,
wow.
That's a cool-ass name, man.
Atticus
right
French.
There.
We didn't get a chance to really talk about the 8-over-8 contract for Philip W. Kessel.
It's right on the money. He's right in his peer group. Now, you may say that for $8 million, you want someone to bring a little bit more, but doesn't this prove one thing? That in the game right now, where as much as they try to open up the game, it is still a defense-first affair, and coaches are more buttoned down than ever. And doesn't it prove one thing more than anything else, Greg Wyshynski? Goals are expensive.
Yeah, they are.
If you're gonna pay for goals, you're gonna pay a lot for goals. And I never thought I'd see a day where Phil Kessel is an $8 million hockey player, but with the salary cap going up to some speculate as much this year as $70 million for a guy that can score 30, 35, maybe even 40 goals a season, that's sort of right on point. Like. No one won this one, okay? Like, Nonis didn't, like, oh, Nonis got the discount on this one. Aha, he wins. Or, you know, oh, Kessel robbed the bank and didn't have to wear a mask. But I will say one thing. I like the way that Wade Arnott played this, his agent. Said, you know, Phil said, we're not negotiating through the year. This is UFA year. He had his number. He said, if you want to come to me on this number, we can talk, but I'm not negotiating during the year. Mm-hmm. And he stuck with it. And so when did the deal get done?
Before the season.
Yeah, that's
but
right.
You kinda have, I'm of two minds of this. Like, on the one hand, it is hard to wrap your brain around the idea that Phil Kessel is in the same conversation as Sidney Crosby, Alex Ovechkin, and Evgeny Malkin.
But they signed their contract. I mean, specifically with Sid and Ovi, they signed their contracts years ago.
True, but he's still in – and if you want to expand it to the other $8 million hit guys and Getzlaff, Perry, and Stahl, you're talking about guys that hit 40 goals or won a cup or both.
Mm-hmm.
And Kessel hasn't done that. And,
but hang on, wouldn't you put him in closer to Claude Giroux, though?
Sure. Who is south of $8 million?
True, but Phil has more goals per game than Claude Giroux has.
No,
and as far as points per game, he's identical.
You are mistaking my devil's advocacy for saying it's a bad contract. Kessel is without question one of the top five offensive players in the game now and within the last 2 years. You can quantify that to be true. And he also has this intangible quality, Merrick, that few wingers possess in this game, which is the ability to make your teammates better, even if they're Tyler Bozak. And I think that's a really important thing. Marty St-Louis has that. Patrick Elias, I think, is another guy that has that. There are a handful of players like Kessel that do what he does, and I don't think that is a quality that is readily available in many wingers. And because of that, I think he's worth the money, despite the money being really, really large.
What have we said before on this podcast? It is always a bonus if you have a guy that can score an easy goal. It's ask Rangers. Ask the New York Rangers under John Tortorella how hard it is to grind out hockey games, how to grind out 2-1 games. If you have a guy that can just snap one in, like breaking sticks, do you know how much tension and how much, you know, how much of a release the team gets when, oh, dot's in, it's on Phil's stick, boom, it's in. Like, just how much easier it makes that game for that team. Just to score an easy goal. It is such a unique skill just to be able to do that. Now, if it comes with other things, leadership, for example, then you're talking about John Tavares. Okay? And no one's ever going to confuse Phil Kessel for John Tavares.
No.
But those easy goals, man, it's so hard to find those types of players.
Indeed. All right. Well, I think we've said all we need to say about fighting and about Phil Kessel and about last night's games. By the way, holy shitballs, the Capitals power play is good. Oh, my God.
One game, bud.
But they were scoring at will. I mean, they didn't miss a beat. And Grabowski coming out of the gate with two power play tallies, not missing a beat with Ribeiro gone. I mean, it's not sustainable, and it's not what you want to be as a hockey team, because when you get to the playoffs and they stop calling penalties, it becomes quite hard to score on the power play. But watching that power play operate last night, and the Caps, I have to go back and watch tape on last season to see if this is something that they've done all the time under Oates, but they collapsed the point man in so tight around the box, mm-hmm. hockey porn, against the Blackhawks PK. And they were passing it well. They were shooting it well. It was really, really well orchestrated and frighteningly good.
See,
I still don't think they're going to be able to go at the same clip they had last year, but really, really good start for that power play.
One of the visuals that I always love about hockey is on a power play that we saw yesterday where the box keeps getting tighter. Where the defenseman sends the pass across, and as soon as he makes that pass, he takes a step forward. It's like an advancing army. When those defensemen just start to pull in, every pass that goes back and forth between the defensemen, the guy that sends the pass takes another step forward. It's almost as if like the march of the inevitable. Like the inevitability of death is coming. We're marching in. That is one of the visuals I will always love about this game.
Indeed. I completely agree. Now with that, I believe it's time for Wednesday favorite.
Oh, we're doing it. Oh, good.
Do you want to do a mailbag segment every week?
It's time to look deep into the souls of Jeff Merrick and Greg Wyshynski. Whoa, not that deep.
We are nutting up for each other here.
Now's your chance to ask Merrick and Wyshynski anything, and we mean anything.
You got your thinking, Took?
Vegan cooking tips. Favorite Doctor Who characters. What's the best bar in Stouffville? Is there a bar in Stouffville?
Hey.
The meaning of life. Wait, let's not get carried away with that.
We answer your mail.
PuckDaddyBlog at yahoo.com. On Twitter at Jeff Merrick and at Wyshynski. We're going postal on Merrick versus Wyshynski.
Oh, by the way, there is a new NHLer from Stouffville. Congratulations, Keith Acton of the Edmonton Oilers yesterday. First NHL shift, first NHL. Oh, did I say Keith? Sorry, yeah. Will Acton. Sorry,
Will
Keith.
Acton.
Yeah, Keith's kind of won a Stanley Cup and all that, assistant coach of the Edmonton Oilers. Congratulations, Will Acton, Stouffville's own.
Oh, I do think Keith Acton would definitely bring something to that lineup that they could have used. Like maybe someone who could help them not give up four goals.
Yes, because
they
need another small, speedy forward. Sure, that's exactly what Edmonton needs.
They need a small, speedy two-way forward, sir, and that was what Keith Acton, I thought, blocked the game.
Good, man. And good hands, too. Great hands on Keith. Yeah, but Will Acton, congratulations. First shift wins the draw. Puck over to Gazdick. Gazdick scores. Will Acton on the game sheet. So no matter what, if he never plays another game, then you know what he can go into? He can go into my cup of coffee book.
Ooh.
Yeah, the one game, guys.
Justin Webster writes in, who was the first one of you to Google what twerking was after the Miley Cyrus nonsense? Now that you both know what it is, who is better at it?
Okay.
Asking for a friend.
Here's the embarrassing thing.
Yeah.
I still don't know what it is. I keep seeing it, and I keep feeling old. But then I'm too lazy to actually go and look it up on Google.
It's sexy dancing you'd see in a club, sir. Where the woman or man would use their buttocks region to tease and tantalize.
I thought it had something to do with Twitter. That's a dumb. I am so out of touch, man. I am the entertainment outsider. I haven't even seen the Miley Cyrus that performance. Where is it?
The MTV Awards.
At the MTV. Yeah. I haven't even seen that.
I knew what twerking was because my girlfriend showed me the Miley Cyrus twerking in the unicorn costume YouTube. If you've never seen it, you can find it, and it frankly has become my spirit animal. It is what's guiding me through life.
Let me ask you a question, because I watch news, sports, and Alan Watts videos. Is this worth my time?
Yes.
At my lot in my it is in my lot in life. Do I need this in my life? Do I?
You should look at the MTV performance where she twerks on Robin Thicke. One, because Robin Thicke is the son of a proud Canadian. And two, because you'll never see a foam finger that you'd get at a game or an arena the same way again.
All right.
Uh-huh.
So this is what I'm doing after the show now?
Yep. Aaron Offinger, thank you for the pronunciation parentheses. I grew up in Irving in the shadow of Texas Stadium and saw a lot of sellouts for good Cowboys teams and a lot of sellouts for bad Cowboys teams. Which NHL fan base do you think is the most resilient? And if the answer is Toronto stupid, which fan base is the most resilient in the U.S.? The answer probably isn't Toronto stupid. It's maybe Edmonton stupid?
Man, Toronto's been at it. I mean, they're walking ATM machines, bud. Doesn't matter how bad the team is. I'll say Toronto. Although Edmonton, yeah, Maddie's right. It's a lot. There's a lot of corporate. But you know, it's always funny. I always sort of laugh when he goes, "Oh, tickets are too expensive at the Air Canada Center. You can't afford to take my kid to a game." You think if they like lowered tickets, it would like open up tickets? I've never understood this idea that if they lower tickets at the Air Canada Center for Maple Leafs games, that all of a sudden there'll be a flood of families. The tickets are already sold. You're not going. They're spoken for.
And as far as the U.S. goes, I think you'd probably have to go with Philly for that resiliency, selling out the building no matter what kind of thing.
You know who was pretty resilient up until a couple of years ago was Minnesota. And there were some bad teams there, bud.
That's a really good choice.
There were some really bad teams there.
And a sellout, not a sellout streak that began during the Lemaire years, no less.
Yeah, think about that. Exactly.
Yeah.
We have superstars. Come watch them not skate. Come watch them not forecheck. They're great in warm-up. Leave after that, because that's the best you're going to see of them.
This was the problem with trying to market the game in the 1990s.
Come watch the superstars of the NHL do nothing as they're clutched and grabbed.
Okay. I'm not going to say who it was who said it, but during our Sportsnet preview show, during one of the breaks, we're talking about Olli Jokinen. Oh, God, this is the line of the year. Okay, so we're shooting the shit about Olli Jokinen right around the table. Cameras are off and everything. We're just, like, talking about various players. And one guy says, "Oh, you know what? You know, you have to really be impressed with Jokinen, who's like turned his life around and is like committed to, you know, fitness and proper nutrition and eating, and he's healthier and all that. He's, you know, picked up a step in his game and all that." And someone else on our panel, I'm not going to say who, turns around and goes, "Oh, really? So now he does nothing but faster. Oh, that's great." Line of the year. Now he does nothing but faster.
Oh, that's brilliant. Devin McIntyre with a good question. Just wondering, what are your thoughts on experiences with gambling and or betting on hockey games? Kind of a broad question, but I thought you might have some interesting opinions.
Not me.
Gambling on hockey is not a thing that happens in the States very often. Although somebody who works with me at Yahoo was lamenting this morning taking the under on the Leafs-Habs game. So over-unders happen, betting on who wins the cup happens, but not a whole lot of head-to-head. You get the goal and a half, I get the two goals kind of gambling happens as far as in the circles that I frequent.
Yeah, me too. I'm just out of the loop too. But I don't go in for, I'm not really a gambling guy to begin with. And I don't run with that crowd. And there are various, you know, a lot of radio shows that are focused around specifically just the gambling, mainly the gambling elements involved in football. Man, do I tune out. Man, does that make sports so boring.
Really?
Yeah, wait, I do.
In the NFL?
Yeah.
Really?
Yep.
Wow,
I don't care.
That's amazing. Because
I don't care about the line and the spread. I don't care about any of that. Really, I don't.
That's because gambling—that's the reason.
I know, but I'm out of touch.
Oh,
I am.
I'll tell you what.
I'm out of it, man.
From a gambling perspective, one of my favorite things that I used to do as a kid was my dad would bring home betting sheets from his job, little betting slips, right? And he would get me one or two.
Yeah.
And what it was you'd pick 20 games, college football, NFL. And if you got them all right, you won like $10,000. And it was like playing the lottery, but at the same time also just having some fun with it. And it all cost you like $2, $3, $5, whatever. They knew you weren't going to win. So it was
you grew up at the track though, right?
Yeah, it's true.
Like you went to the track a ton. So like this is part of like your formative years. Like you associate
sports right?
with you know, putting a nickel on a thing or two.
I'm starting to wonder what my dad was doing to me.
He's listening. Dad, like, call in.
Dad, what are those white lines on the table? Oh, nothing, son. Just put it up your nose. You'll feel great.
Let's keep you alert. Keep you awake. That's all. I hate this stuff. Sure, I love the way it smells, but still.
Right, exactly. Oh, come on, Robin Williams jokes.
No, it's a Rodney Dangerfield joke.
Are those a Robin Williams joke?
Dude, that guy's horked so many jokes. I know.
That's a great point. Put it this way. It was a Dangerfield joke.
Put it this way. On one of the hockey teams in the league that I play with, this a league of the arts, it's like radio and TV and entertainers. This is one team that's comprised. No, I'm serious. It's like one team is comprised of like only comedians, and they'll tell the stories of like comedians who will just like get a check in the mail from Robin Williams saying, hey, you know, I don't want to ever be accused of stealing, but I'm going to use your joke, but here's some money for it.
Take my wife, please. Andrew Lycus, random future penguin Ilya Bryzgalov, calm down.
Oh, wouldn't that be fun?
I was wondering if you guys could pull back the curtain a little on the podcast. What do you guys do to prep for the show? How much do you guys have planned to talk about during the show and during interviews? Well, we call each other earlier in the day, and we kind of kick around some ideas. Let me put it this way. The show that we do on the phone is better than the show that we do on the podcast.
Yeah, that show can be really fun. We bitch about our lives for about 10 minutes. Okay, what are we going to do in the podcast today? You know, here's the weird thing about this whatever this thing is, this podcast. Before the podcast, like, I'll go to the gym in the morning, and then I'll, like, do some reading, call some people on the way back. And then, you know, Greg does the same thing. And he'll, like, do his blog. And then when the podcast's over, I'll go and do television, and Greg will, you know, do more blog posts. And this is, like, it's like Greg and I both have our lives. We hit pause on our lives for an hour or so, more or less, mainly more most days. And then that little slice of our lives is gone, and it's back to, like, the regular gig. Like, to me, this is like this little area where it doesn't feel like my part of the gig. It doesn't feel like part of my job or anything like that. And as far as, like, right, the show prep for it goes, I don't know. There's not like a space of time where it's like, okay, and now I'm going to prep for the show. It's just everything that you've experienced or remembered or read about or watched or talked to someone about just goes into the show. Like, I didn't know we were going to talk to Matthew Barnaby about Ken Hitchcock. We started. So, like, shit, why not bring up the Todd Harvey incident? Yeah. This isn't something you prepared for. Like, the one thing I've always said about talk radio, which, let me know if you're with me or against me on this one. The only thing you can do in talk radio is plan a backup plan. Because the first instinct is go with what's working. Go with what feels right and go with the conversation. That's why the nature of a long form show like this without radio breaks for traffic and sports and stop sets and all that kind of stuff is so much more rewarding to me. It's so much more fun for me. Because you're able to work through a thought. You're able to have an extended conversation. No more of those. There's none of those, well, hold that thought, Greg, and we're going to pick that thought up in a couple of seconds. But first, let me tell you about Tim Hortons coffee. There's none of that. Now, there are podcasts that do that, that'll stop in the middle of conversation for sponsor plugs. But the one thing that I kind of like about not being sponsored is we can kind of do whatever we want. You know what I mean?
I do what you mean. And if you want to do whatever you want, make sure you check out Expedia.com. Now, Expedia has a wonderful interface that you can really, really go anywhere you want to. And they give you a car, a hotel, and a plane at one great rate. Expedia.com. EGM writes in, has the readership dropped since the hideous site change on Puck Daddy? Oh. I, for one, can't stand going there now. And I loved Puck Daddy, but it's become unreadable. I don't know the numbers. All I can tell you, once again, is that they're working on it. They're working on getting the baseball background off the site. They're working on making the functionality work. I understand there's a lot of bugs, and I understand there's a lot of frustration. There's actually more frustration behind the scenes than there is for you, the readers, because we've been working through a lot of technical difficulties on the site.
I know that.
But this is the God's honest truth. As much as I've had problems with the redesign, it's kind of grown on me a little bit. Not the front page of the site. I still think there's some problems there. But when you click on an article, the look of the article and everything and the sidebars and all the other stuff has kind of grown on me a little bit. I like it. I like it a bit better than I did at first glance, to be honest with you.
The only thing that I don't like about it is your picture, young Republican.
Well, I don't like the idea that they got rid of the cigar picture.
I know.
Iconic.
That was awesome. That was great.
It was iconic. Well, yeah,
we keep it. We've kept it for the podcast, right?
We have, yeah. That Matthew Toy has four questions for us. We'll take them one at a time.
All right.
Favorite thing about your job? Favorite thing about the job for me would be the, as Merrick kind of noted, not only on the podcast but on the blog, the unpredictability of what you're going to write about that day, what you're going to talk about that day, and the leeway from very gracious employers to be able to do what you want in covering those topics and not be forced to write the 50 greatest shots that Sidney Crosby made. A slideshow.
A slideshow. For me, it's easy. It's this, the podcast. That's it. TV's a lot of fun. You know, filling in on radio is a trip too, but nothing beats being able to talk with you guys for an hour every day.
Favorite player you ever met? Boy, that's a great question.
Bobby Orr.
David Backus.
David Backus? I thought you said Jim Pack there for a second. Really, Jim Pack?
My two favorite talkers are David Backus and Carl Alsner. So one of those two probably.
For me, Bobby Orr. That was a trip. That was my favorite. He was my favorite like growing up. Like, I just caught the tail end, but you know, that was your guy. Maddie is chiming in with Steve Yzerman. But he just loved those.
Yzerman was the first guy I ever interviewed doing as a hockey writer. That was sort of the intimidation thing, because I'm with Matt. Like, I was a huge Yzerman fan, mm-hmm. and this is the first sort of surreal, wow, this is really my profession moment was I got a chance to talk to him at the draft one year. Right. There you go. Least favorite player you ever met, if you can answer that one, Matt says. My least, I could say that without a second thought. Joe Corvo is a dick. Joe Corvo
was
a giant, simpering dick.
For me, I mean, it was Ty, because we kind of had a thing for a while, but we're all cool now.
Who?
Actually, Domi.
Oh, Domi. Right,
yeah, we had
right.
a thing for a while, but we're all good now. Actually, we had a great time in Halifax, two of the juniors. The top prospects last year, me and Ty. I can't think. Yeah, he really did hate me then too. I can't really think of one. No, it was Ty, but that's all cool now. It's all cool in the gang.
Favorite movie, TV show? It changes based on how I'm feeling about life. But if I had to answer it in a general sense, it would be taking Star Wars out of the equation, because it's not a movie; it's an experience. Die Hard, Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Die Hard, eh?
Die Hard's the perfect movie.
Not RoboCop, eh? Okay. TV show.
But if you put RoboCop in Nakatomi Plaza, you might have something.
Now I'm warming up on this mug of hot chocolate. TV show. You know what? 6 Feet Under was my favorite.
Was it really?
Yeah, I loved everything about 6 Feet Under. I adored that show. Probably 6 Feet Under, and then movie. God, I might have to say Jaws. God, I love Jaws.
Oh.
The Hiroshima bomb. Oh, so good. Yeah, probably Jaws. I mean, it's too easy to say Citizen Kane. We all love Citizen Kane, and that's freaking fantastic.
Two more before we go. This one is up your alley, sir, because we were actually talking about it during our prep call before. From Michael in Winnipeg, how great was Jacob Trouba's debut last night for the Mighty Jets?
Well, I don't want to say the only reason I do yoga is to do this, but let me just bend over and pleasure myself. Was it not a Jeff Merrick from a week ago that said, or maybe even earlier on this week, who said the Minnesota-Winnipeg feud is going to be kicked off with Jacob Trouba destroying someone on the Minnesota Wild, like Mikko Koivu or Zach Parise, or someone like that. Mm-hmm. Did you see him run at Taylor Hall yesterday? That was, listen, it was a little bit dangerous. It was more than a little bit reckless. But as far as establishing who you are early, hi, Chris Pronger. Isn't that what Jacob Trouba did yesterday? Like, serve notice. Mm-hmm. There's a new young shark in the water here.
Totally.
I love Trouba last night. Played I love Scheifele really last well. Night, too.
Scheifele was apparent.
Scheifele was great. Trouba
Scheifele
was great.
Was noticeable, which is more than you could say for a lot of the times we've seen Scheifele play. Two quick ones. First off, this is one. Let me see here. I just found it on Twitter, and I thought it was a salient point. Thomas Strangward about Peros. Wouldn't Peros have been helped by wearing a visor? That's my rebuttal.
Wouldn't he have been helped by wearing a visor? He was going down with enough force. That face was still hitting the ice.
I think with the visor,
the visor could have cracked and it could have split open his face.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Seen that before. Yeah, you know what would have helped? A full face shield. That's about it. But are we ready to go there? Or are we going to stick with a half measure with the quarter visor?
Finally, Josh P. writes in, the Peros scene last night. This is only fair that we do this side of the fighting argument,
of course,
sir, because this is what we should do. Because we are smart guys, and maybe we can use our powers for the forces of the enemy.
I didn't know what twerking was until today, so I'm not a smart dude.
What is the best way, in your opinion, to take fighting out of the game but still protect players from each other? More match penalties, stiffer fines, Merrick with a high-powered paintball rifle in the rafters after every game. My suggestion is to move two players who have agreed to fight to a suitable barn-like nearby location for a bout refereed by Brian Burke. Josh has some fun with it, but I have to admit that it is intriguing to think if there is some way to still police the game whilst taking fighting out of it. I don't know if you could without really cracking down on, like, stick work. But, I mean, part of my whole thing with fighting is the idea that it is, as I said, the cork that keeps all of the evil inside of the bowels of the earth. But if you were to convince me that there is a way to ensure that evil is kept in check without fighting, then I'd be willing to listen to it. I'd give you the ratio. We need to consider the ban on fighting.
But don't you think a lot of it is just the fear of the unknown? Like, if they, you know, made aggressive moves to get fighting completely out of the game, I know a lot of people who, you know, live in, you know, in Santa Claus land want to pretend that, you know, in Sunshine and Rainbows land, want to pretend that if you get fighting out of the game, that nothing else will happen and the game will just be fantastic. But no, you know, it's my, you know, one of our favorite Buddhist sayings. This is because that is. There will be an effect. Something will happen when you remove something or add something. If you take fighting out of the game, what happens? And you know what the answer is? No one knows. And isn't that at the heart of what one of the great fears about this is? If we take fighting out, what goes in that vacuum? What happens?
And I don't think it's as easy as putting a face shield on or adjusting the goalie pads. I don't know if you can come back from a ban on fighting to re-implement it if you don't like.
Oh no, you can't. That's why the NHL can never put the instigator back in. But you know what?
Exactly. Okay, you can't do, because that's what you, because the copious amounts of shit you would take from the media for doing
totally.
That.
But here's an interesting thing about the instigator penalty. God, I can't believe it's taken me 3 years to bring this up on the podcast. Maybe I have, and I'm just dumb enough forgot. But if you go back and look at hockey in the 70s and hockey in the 60s and hockey even in the 50s, right? Instigator penalty existed. It wasn't called the instigator penalty. But more times than not, the player who started the fight got an extra 2 minutes for either unsportsmanlike conduct or roughing. Then the problem was they actually made it a thing, the instigator penalty. And now, to your point, Wish, there is no going back. If they just would have left it, referee's discretion. You started the fight, you're sitting for an extra two, and just called it roughing. Dave Schultz, 5 minutes for fighting, two for roughing. That penalty already existed in the NHL. They just didn't call it the instigator. They just didn't. But it's not new. The idea, and that's why I find it so hilarious when I hear people saying, well, the instigator penalty, you know, is killing the game. Before, when they didn't have the instigator, things, you know, you could paralyze yourself. Nonsense. There still was an extra two that referees would hand out frequently for the guy that started the fight. It happened.
Finally, we go to veteran Puck Daddy reader Gerald Morton. Dear Jeff and Greg, in order of who is more likely to take off their skates and try to stab a guy. This is true. I wouldn't take off my skate to stab a guy. I would just have a shank on me somewhere. To borrow a phrase from my late dad, I'm sick and effing tired of the hockey media's obsession with straw men. Every instance of injury or unnecessary fight leads to a mass of columns about how fighting is archaic and not needed. Of course, you're watching a goddamn sport, but by their nature they are archaic, masculinized idiocy. This is sort of the point. They are raw emotion and physicality filtered through a tradition of practice and rulemaking. So stop with your straw men. Hockey doesn't need X, Y, or Z, (Z), please. Hockey isn't needed. It's an invented tradition. It doesn't require hitting, more dangerous slap shots, or shot blocking. If you don't like fighting, then just say so. Stop pretending we are talking about additions to an otherwise pure spectacle. It's all spectacle.
Let me ask you this question. I was talking about this this morning with one of my producers. From an injury point of view, from a player safety point of view, rank these three things, Greg.
All right.
What produces more injuries? Okay. Body checks, blocked shots, fighting.
Body checks, blocked shots, or fighting. What causes more injury?
Yeah. What's the cause of more injuries? Because I would go exactly in that order.
Yeah, I would say the amount of padding on a player in today's game would make that. I would put that behind a body check, for sure. Yeah, I think you might be right. I think that might be the correct order. Now, the potential for catastrophic injury in those three, how would you rank them?
Block shot first.
Uh-huh.
Fighting second. Block shot first, body checking second, and fighting third. Because the thing about fighting is, you're agreeing to do it, and you're prepared to do it, right? And most of the times, people that do it know how to do it. Body checks, you have your head down. If you're a little bit sloppy, you got the puck in your skates, you could get really hurt bad. And block shots, ask the guy that won't autograph his picture of his broken leg. Or ask Ian LaPerriere what block shots are all about.
Right, right.
Like, there will be someone in the future who dies in this game. Sounds awful. I don't want to sound frivolous about it, and I'm not, but someone's going to die in this game. I'm willing to bet it's from a shot in the head. Not from a fist, but from a puck.
I would tend to agree with that.
With everyone, the nature of shots now, and the way that with everyone blocking shots, how defensemen have to get the puck up a little bit to get it to the nets. And that's why I'm not a big proponent of the bigger nets, like the higher nets, because I think we need to do everything to make sure the puck stays as low as possible.
Low.
Right?
I will agree with those who say, though, that if we ever saw a guy die in a fight, it would be like the Peros thing last night. It would be that kind of situation, head hitting the ice.
Fighting I don't think it would go away. I don't think guys would fight as much for a little while, and then it would come back. You know, what happened to the epidemic? Again, I'm not sounding frivolous about this. What happened to the quote unquote epidemic a couple of summers ago of fighters dying? That just stopped?
Are you saying that those three deaths may not have been related because they were all fighters?
Wow, really? That's not what the columns upon columns upon columns of what I read, how this is the beginning of an epidemic. And fighters are dying en masse.
The only epidemic aspect of that I thought was Bugard, in the sense that it really did pull the curtain back on the just completely irresponsible medical care that this guy was given.
True. Yeah.
And that was important.
There have been plenty of players, all right? Plenty of players who have had those types of dependencies. And they're not all fighters. Now, those guys get in a bad way. I know one person who was a fighter for a number of years in the NHL who had significant chemical dependency issues and tried to commit suicide twice. And he was a fighter. I know one guy who's in the NHL today who is not a tough guy who once upon a time tried to commit suicide.
Yeah. It's a
like that summer. I remember when it happened, and it was an easy article to write because you saw three fighters die. It was an easy one. We're on the beginning of an and we kept everyone. I think level-headed people kept saying this is just a coincidence. This is not a trend at this point. Let's do something significant. Let's see what happens here and what happened. You know what? It's like, remember the headline before 9/11, like on 9/10. Remember what the big scourge in the world was? Remember that summer?
Sharks.
Shark attacks.
Yeah.
And then what? Osama Palooza happened, and all of a sudden, what? Sharks said, ooh, hang on. This guy's really serious. We better calm our act down. What? Sharks just stopped? You stopped biting people?
Indeed. All right, everybody. That, I believe, is all we have to say about fighting today. Join us tomorrow.
We said that half an hour ago.
Join us tomorrow for more on Fight Talk.
Yeah, on Fight Talk Radio.
Fight Talk Radio. Anyway, that's the show for today. Thank you to Matthew Barnaby for chiming in. Thank you to all the people who chimed in on Going Postal, a Wednesday favorite.
And thanks and congratulations to Canucks fan in San Francisco on the birth of your beautiful lockout baby. That's fantastic. Love it.
Before we go, Jeff Merrick, I understand that tonight is, in fact, rivalry night on NBC.
I love the idea of rivalry night, although I have a hard time getting excited about two rivals who have never once met in the playoffs. The Buffalo Sabres and the Detroit Red Wings. The Buffalo Sabres came into the NHL in 1970. They're in the 70 expansion with the Vancouver Canucks. Should have been in 1967, but, I don't know, the Maple Leafs blocked them. Oops, sorry, not coming into the NHL. I had to wait 3 years, Seymour Knox. I apologize. So they go back 1970. They've played against each other. I counted before the show 126 times. Zero games in the playoffs against each other. This is a rivalry. Explain, how is this a rivalry?
Rivalry night.
They've never met in the playoffs. There is no animosity. There's no burning issue. But tonight, that all changes. Really? Based on what? John Scott going after Henrik Zetterberg on the draw?
Yeah.
Or is it the Battle of the Millers? As our producer said. Like, I'm like, how is this a rivalry? And he goes, hey, come on, it's the Millers.
Good one, Maddie.
All right, excited everybody. About rivalry night, I wish.
We will see you on the morrow, ladies and gentlemen. Bye.